Hi everyone, Anthony Fantano here, internet's busiest music nerd, here with a very special episode in this new edition of the podcast. I have a fellow YouTuber, a fellow critic, but in a totally different artistic medium, one Mr. Chris Stuckman, who has a fantastic YouTube channel that I will link you down to in the description box, where he regularly reviews movies of numerous genres, gives very well-balanced and well-thought-out opinions, and I just thought I would bring him on because over the past few months I've grown to be a fan of his, but also I think it would just be great to sort of pull two different critics of two different mediums together and just kind of discuss exactly what separates those mediums and what it means to be a music critic versus a movie critic and just kind of a critic in general.
Well, thank you, man, for having me on. I appreciate that. And I'm flattered that you enjoy my videos. That's very kind of you. Thank you so much.
I do. I mean, I thought that in your videos, you just come off real passionate. You come off knowledgeable. And I mean, though, you know, you don't try to portray this false idea that I think a lot of critics try to, that they know everything.
Right.
Pre-game this interview, I watched that whole video that you did on just film criticism in general.
Got it.
And it was awesome that you sort of brought up Siskel and Ebert, because that was a bit of an inspiration for me personally, because I didn't really grow up reading music magazines, but I know there are a lot of music writers who have, but I didn't really grow up reading music magazines. I mean, watching stuff like Siskel and Ebert just come off as very knowledgeable but personable, you know, was just so much more inspiring for me. I mean, even when they would rip a movie apart, there was some kind of like hilarity to it, or even when they would sort of say a movie is mediocre or lackluster. Sort of a one review that comes to mind is like when they were reviewing some of the Home Alone movies, which I remember they thought were incredibly bad or just like very mediocre.
Yeah.
But even in the review, they were like, listen, like, we don't like these, but we know that like all the kids in America will hate us for not liking them.
Of
you
course.
Know, sort of acknowledging the public opinion as sort of being legitimate and different from your own. You know, that kind of stuff to me is just more inspiring as a critic, because it doesn't sound like, you know, a critic kind of in the stereotypical sense. It sounds like you're a fan.
Yeah, and that's exactly how I feel. I've never ever approached movies or really anything and been like, I'm just this snooty guy who just knows all this. I have all this information. I'm constantly, and this is the absolute truth, I am constantly surprised that people watch my videos.
I am as well.
I
am as well, because I mean, I kind of, and I don't mean to surprise people watch your videos. I'm surprised that people watch my videos sometimes.
Right. No, you know, I understand.
Because I still feel like I'm a regular guy sometimes.
That's exactly,
you know,
how I feel.
Like,
when I went to Comic-Con recently and I had the privilege to go on a couple of panels, it was the first time I've ever been on a panel.
That's amazing.
Amazing. The first time I've ever been on a panel ever. I'm sitting there and I'm looking at, you know, like 100, 150 people, 200 people who have come to this room, and I'm just like, what is going on with my life right now? And you know, all these people are coming up to you and they're like, I love your videos. You inspired me. You know, you got me through my hospital stay. You got me through my parents' divorce, all this crazy stuff that I've never, ever thought I could ever have an impact on. And somehow I am. And it's very humbling, to the point of just almost wanting to cry. Like, I was standing there in front of these people and I was like, oh shit, like, don't cry. And it was just a really great moment. And I think I feel very similar to you, actually, because I am just a regular guy. I'm a guy in Ohio who loves movies. I have a passion for film. I have a passion for talking about movies. And my whole goal is always just to try to appear as if, you know, I'm just your buddy who wants to talk about movies with you. And that's how I feel. So it helps that I'm not being fake. I'm being real. I anyone who wants to talk in movies with me, talk movies with me, like at a theater or anywhere, there's a guy at a gas station near my house. I go to this gas station all the time, and every time I come in there, I don't know his name, he doesn't know my name, but every time I come in there, he's like, hey, you see Captain America? Hey, you see this? You see that? And I'm like, yeah, and then we talk about it. It's just, it's this infectious thing that can happen, and I love it.
That's awesome. I mean, I've gotten similar stories as well. Like, and again, you know, you're just thinking about how you are just reviewing movies, which, I mean, even as a fan in the greater scheme of things, you don't think it's a super big deal, but to other people, it's a super big deal. But I mean, you know, really when you think about it at its inception, I think when you're a fan of something for so long, not that you lose passion for it, but you sort of forget about how big of a deal it can be to you and to other people too. And it sort of pulls you out of that context of thinking it's a big deal when other people are like running up to you and being like, "Oh man, I love your videos. It's so great that you review this and say that and have all these criticisms and so on and so forth." But you know, if you think back to sort of that point of inception where you really just like fell in love with the genre or the medium of film, I'm sure it's easy to recollect just how big of a deal it was for you in your life at that point. I mean, I remember in high school just how huge of a deal music was for me. I mean, like everything in my life revolved around music. Like all I wanted to do was learn about music and just hear music and explore music in just every facet that I could possibly.
Yeah, no, I can vividly remember it. And I'm also a big music fan too. Nowhere near as knowledgeable as you are. People.
Oh, we're going to get into awesome. That. I'm going to ask you some of your favorite records. Awesome. And I have some of my favorite DVDs over here.
Okay. Very so. Cool. I'm excited for that because that's different. Usually it's always a movie podcast that wants to have me on. So it's cool. I can actually do something different. I vividly remember everything really. And I've told the story to my viewers, but there's always new viewers. So, and I'll make it brief. I don't want to bore you. I don't want to do a Kevin Smith where I just like go off on this huge tangent. I love Kevin Smith. But anyway, I was always in love with movies as a child. My parents showed me movies like The Princess Bride and the original Star Wars films and Back to the Future and Hook and the Home Alone films. And I always thought they were so cool. And I remember having the eyes of innocence and being so naive to think that I was peering into some sort of world in which this exists, whatever sure. I'm looking at, that's real, that exists, that happened, and someone somehow put it together and I'm experiencing it. And then
when we were younger, that was a very vivid time for sure. Film.
Yeah.
You know, so it's easy to sort of think of kids at that time seeing it and, you know, sort of mistaking it for reality in a
sense. Absolutely, yeah.
You know, with older movies, I mean, which were great and might have been great, you know, there were all sorts of things that, like the fact that you were watching it in black and white and the quality of the picture that I'm sure was easy for people to sort of separate it from reality. Mm-hmm. But sort of, you know, the 80s, 90s, it was a very vivid time for film for its time.
Definitely, definitely. And I remember my mom rented me The Sandlot from the library, and I watched that movie endlessly, and I bought my own, well, my parents bought it for me. But yeah, it wasn't until I was about 13 or 14 that I really started to become aware of the idea that movies could be made by a group of people, and mm-hmm. that there was somebody involved with the production, and that there were all these various people who sat down and actually assembled this film, and that I could do that too if I put my mind to it. So yeah, I saw this film called Signs, directed by M. Night Shyamalan, and I loved it, and it inspired me to want to get my own camera, and I begged my mom to get me a camera. We weren't dirt poor, but we certainly didn't have much money, and she let me buy a reasonably priced camera, and it spent most of my teenage years being used with my friends, tons of short films, hundreds really. I still have them all saved. They'll never see the light of day. I had them all on these. I had like four or five VHS tapes of them, which I've since transferred to DVD so that I could preserve them just, you know, for my own sake. And one day when I'm 55 or something, I'll be like, here's one of them. Laugh at me. I spent my whole teenage years just obsessing over studying film and not just, you know, watching a lot of movies. I mean, hardcore studying film and people, my sister talks to me a lot. She's like, you sound like a frickin' computer when you're talking about movies. I'm like, what do you mean? And she's like, you're just spouting out all of this information. Where does this come from? And I'm like, it's just in my head, years of studying. And so
I was just out to dinner last night with one of my good friends and my wife. And we were sitting down at the table. And I think at this point, I can't remember how it came up, but I think at this point I've reviewed upwards of like maybe 1,000 records. And I said to them, here's my phone, go on my YouTube channel, find any review that I did, and I'll remember the score I gave it.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely.
and they were just like asking me random records that I reviewed. I'm like, oh yeah, that was pretty good. I gave that a 7, yeah. You know, or something. Yeah. And it's weird how when you're passionate about something, you don't even really need to think about remembering it. You just automatically
remember it. And you know, I can do the same thing as well. You name any movie, I can probably name the grade. Also, this is the freaky one. And there's no way I can prove this, but it's true. If you tell me any film that I saw in theaters, save for when I was, you know, like maybe, you know, less than 13 years old, I can remember where I was sitting.
Like in what row?
Yes. Not like, you know, row 8, not like row A, row 8, you know, seat 8. I can remember like the position in the theater. Like, I was back left that time, or I was back right that time. And I apologize if you hear a lawnmower. Some guy outside just started mowing a lawn.
Yeah, that's fine. But what's interesting about that is that that's not to say that that's an easy thing to recollect, but sort of thinking of how much you obsess over this medium, sort of your first impact of seeing that movie in the theater, I'm sure a lot of your memory is guided by sort of the angle you were looking at the screen from.
You're exactly right.
You know, so the fact of that, I'm sure, you know, exactly, you're pulling right from your mind. Okay, so I mean, I remember seeing the film sort of in this way, so I must have been sitting here.
Yeah, you got it.
Nuts.
I can't even remember who I was with. I'm serious. Like, I have a vivid memory of seeing Bringing Down the House with Steve Martin and Queen Latifah with an older lady who was family friends. And she took me to the movie theater. And her name was, I forgot her name. See, I can't remember her name, but I remember like who she was. I remember she had a problem looking at lights. She wore a lot of sunglasses. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, just like you when I was a kid, I mean, I never had that point where I obsessed over the film in the same way that you have, which is exactly why when people say, hey, you know, Anthony, we really love your reviews. Are you ever going to do movie reviews? Like, that's the moment that I'm just in my head. I'm like, no, you know, I've never had that point in my life where I was so obsessed with movies in the way I was with music. I think the only way I'd be able to explain myself or sort of critique the movie is if I thought the storyline and the acting was good. You know, when I watch your stuff, you're talking about like camera angles and all sorts of things that, and sort of some of the interesting ways that directors will sort of portray a whole scene without cutting anywhere, you know, just by moving the camera in a few ways, which is stuff that I don't necessarily notice on my, you know, really, really any view of a movie, because that's not really my prime focus, because that's not anything I've really sort of obsessed over. But still, like you, as a kid, I remember seeing movies and thinking of them as being this really cool alternative world that I really wanted to be in or be involved in.
Exactly.
You know, as a kid, I remember loving the shit out of Ghostbusters. Loved Ghostbusters. Yeah. Loved Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Right, right.
Thought Home Alone was the greatest thing. Loved Beetlejuice. Beetlejuice was amazing. Yeah. You know, just these movies that brought these really weird alternative worlds to the forefront. And even as a kid, I mean, I liked some weird horror movie stuff too. And in high school, I did kind of get obsessed with, you know, just really bad horror movies because, you know, that stuff that's just like so bad, it's good. And oddly enough, sort of a weird drug themed movies as well. you know, though as a kid in high school, I wouldn't go anywhere near drugs.
Yeah.
Like I wouldn't, but I was completely infatuated with like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. I thought that was like the coolest thing.
Yeah. My ex-girlfriend loved that movie so much. She would show it to me all the time.
It was interesting sort of listening to the Hunter S. Thompson commentary where he was talking about the scenes that Terry Gilliam was pulling together. And then in the midst of doing the scenes and sort of visualizing them, Terry had admitted to a Hunter that he had never done like these drugs that he's talking about doing throughout the film.
And so he was just like, you know, completely working from imagination as to what these trips and what these situations would look and be
interesting.
Like. But yeah, you know, just I had this point where I was just really obsessed with, you know, these drug movies and sort of these bad horror movies like Jack Frost.
Oh my God.
That movie where the snowman comes alive and kills people.
Now, those
are amazing.
Which Jack Frost horror movie? The actual horror movie or the Michael Keaton Jack Frost?
Yeah, that which is also a horror exactly. movie in its own right.
Exactly.
But, well, speaking of Michael Keaton... one movie that you've seen recently that I know you enjoyed and I enjoyed it too was Birdman.
Yeah, loved it.
You loved the hell out of that movie.
I did.
But speaking about critics, like we were earlier, the one thing I didn't like about that movie was that whole critic character,
sure.
which I don't know, just kind of seemed like a straw man of sorts. Mm-hmm. Like not that critics don't have their flaws or don't deserve their criticisms, mm-hmm. but it kind of seemed like they were criticizing an effigy of a critic
right.
in the movie. Like they put together the most dislikable critic to shit all over. And then it was like, well, of course, you know, of course I have to agree with you
yeah.
when your portrayal of the critic is that.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even like that person.
No, of course. And they're most critics that I've ever met are really just people who are really passionate about movies. But I can tell you, and of course I will never name names. I have met some film critics where I have left talking to them and I've said to myself, why do they review movies? Like, what do they actually enjoy this? Because I went to this sure. screening one time and it's no one that anyone on the internet would know. I'm saying it's not anyone that anyone on the internet would know. It's a small time critic here in Ohio who is kind of like me. He's just, you know, he's just kind of a normal person. And I was talking to this person, and also if any of my friends are watching this, I'm not friends with this person, so I'm just like covering my tracks. But anyway, and they were just talking about how bored they were all the time, and oh, I go to these movies, and oh, I'm going to see Fast and the Furious, oh, I'm going to see Thor. I'm like, will you shut up? You get paid to watch movies, dude. Like, just relax.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Well, I think the thing is, and this goes for all criticism, you know, across genres. I think a lot of people who end up in the business are there because they're good writers, not necessarily because they're fantastic fans of the media.
It's true.
You know, they're there because they can write very well. They can explain points very well. And they probably already have a track history of working in the journalism industry as a writer of some sort, and they just kind of end up here, and it seems kind of like a cozy spot that slowly over time, if you're not a fan, sort of becomes your own little torture chamber.
You're absolutely correct.
Which is. Sort of the stereotype that I try to break as hard as possible, because I've just always been a fan. I've always cared about music, and you know, I don't consider myself the greatest writer in the world. You know, though I've taken plenty of journalism courses, and that was sort of a focus for me in college. But I've always considered myself a better talker, but first and foremost, a fan. Which, you know, even whether I could write or not, that's sort of where my passion to do what I do sort of comes from, the fact that I care about music so much.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I can tell when I watch your videos too, and that's one of the things that I look for whenever I, you know, I'm curious to see any videos or articles about anything, is I always want to find someone who feels like they actually enjoy what they're doing and have a passion for it, and that definitely comes through in your videos. I mean, you it's really obvious that you're infectiously. Like, I watch your videos and I'm like, you know, I actually might listen to that album that I have no interest in.
Sure. And I think at the end of the day, that's what makes a lot of your fans and my fans so passionate. I mean, in one breath, while we do feel like, hey, you know, this is crazy, you know, not that we think our videos are bad, but I'm sure Chris feels the same way that I do, that never in a million years did we think that we'd be doing what we're doing.
Correct.
And
yeah.
And it's crazy to yeah. us. You know, it's still kind of crazy to be such a big fan of such a thing and essentially, like, you know, be making a name for yourself just by being such a huge fan. And And the reason people love the videos is because I think that connection that people make to other people when they discuss cultural items, pieces of art that they're really passionate about, that could be really emotionally vindicating, and that could be really significant to other people, which again is part of the reason that I sort of got into music in the first place. It was through my friends, you know. I mean, I've always had some kind of passion for music, but when it really kind of lit up, it was when, you know, some really close friends of mine who I had met early on in life heard my music. They thought that was cool. I tried out their music. Then we were looking up music together and, you know, just kind of further diving down that rabbit hole. You know, I think the communication of fans together and sort of sharing in the things that they're passionate about can be really, really important.
You know, it's funny. I just watched the perfect movie to then jump into a podcast with you earlier today when I had some free moments. I had to take my dog to the vet and blah, blah, blah. Have you ever seen High Fidelity?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's about these.
That's like ultimate music nerd.
Yeah. Movie. Yeah, yeah, it's John Cusack, Jack Black, and they work at a music store, and the whole movie is just they're like these super high brow guys who like look down on people with poor music taste, and they love to, like, people will come into the shop and ask for a record, and Jack Black's like, you don't need that thing, and he'll like convince them to buy something else, and so yeah, I mean, it's a perfect segue into talking to the music lover over here. It's awesome.
I remember Empire Records was a good 90s movie about a record store, too.
You are just pulling out the ex-girlfriend's favorites.
Oh, man. that was actually an ex-girlfriend's favorite of mine. So
yeah, it's true. No, she loved it. She forced me to watch it. I actually liked it, though. I had no interest in it, but I liked it.
Yeah, Empire Records was fun. And another interesting sort of acting moment for record stores was this great, great Kids in the Hall sketch where this guy comes in like looking for, I don't know what, some kind of freaking Hall & Oates record or something. And the dude behind the counter is scoffing at him, and the customer sort of looks him up and down, and, you know, he's sort of profiling him, like, what's this guy's deal? What's his taste? You know, what is he into? And he says, you know, could you recommend me any Doors records? And the guy's like, the Doors? You're not ready for the Doors, man. And, you know, he's like, well, how do I get into him? What do I do? And he's like, do this. Buy a car. Get an 8-track. It's got to have an 8-track. You know, get L.A. Woman on there, or like Morrison Hotel, and drive it all the way out to the desert. You know, and he's like going through this whole elaborate, you know, scheme. And he's like, quit your job and all this other stuff. And then you'll be into the Doors, man.
That's
you know?
Funny. My dad used to play the Doors all the time when I was a kid. Riders on the Storm over and over again. Good song. Great song. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've always enjoyed their music. But yeah, I grew up with, well, you're going to get into the music later. I'll talk about it then.
Sure. Oh, okay. Well, I think one more. here's something that is was an interesting other little movie tidbit for me. Growing up, I sort of had these kids movies or movies that sort of were a little more kid friendly that I thought were really great. But I was exposed to a lot of adult movies too through my dad, because he wasn't, you know, sort of one of these parents who was sort of overly protective mm-hmm. of what their kids saw. And these movies that were more adult in nature, I mean, I saw them again and again and again and again, because he loved the hell out of these movies. Like, my dad, while he wasn't necessarily a movie expert or a movie buff, the movies that he did love, he watched them religiously to the point where he could quote every word from them.
Of course.
So I remember growing up, I can't tell you how many times I watched the movie Predator.
Oh my god! I thought you were going to say Predator. I kid you not. I thought you were going to say Predator.
Dude, my dad was he's still a big man today. He was a power lifter, very much a loudmouthed, loud man's man, and like, you know, Arnold movies, but specifically Predator was like his shit.
What is this fucking tie business, huh?
I know. Pretty much every line from that movie, he could just quote it verbatim.
Yeah, yeah, you got pushing too many pencils.
Oh my god, yes, yes. Get to the chopper! Get to the chopper! The only time that Predator got kicked out of the main movie rotation is when Matrix came out. Like it's like you know, a bomb dropped for him, you know, and then he just became obsessed with the Matrix trilogy, you know, and he has all these sorts of theories about how the Matrix works and all this other stuff. And, you know, by the time they came out with the third one, he had all these, like, you know, theoretical ideas as to where it's going to go. And I'm like, I think the Matrix is done, you know, it's, but you know, he's still like holding out hope for some kind of advancement of the narrative into the future.
Your dad sounds pretty awesome.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a super, super passionate guy as well, you know, just kind of has his own, you know, his own, focuses. But, I mean, as far as movies that I've kind of fallen in love with over the years, and this is just a couple DVDs. I mean, you know, I really love, The Meaning of Life, favorite Monty Python movie, though I've seen them all. Trainspotting, love Trainspotting. That came from sort of my drug movie phase, obviously. Royal Tenenbaums, definitely one of my favorite Wes Anderson movies, though I haven't caught up on a lot of his recent stuff.
Very hilarious film.
Absolutely. No Country for Old Men. Definitely,
so
definitely a newer movie that blew me away from the first moment
I saw it.
I mean, Javier Bardem's character is definitely one of the most amazing characters to ever be on film. Eraserhead is fantastic. Full Metal Jacket, that's really intense. I already said Fear and Loathing. You know, I sort of like in the way that No Country for Old Men is, I just love a good character portrait of just like a real dark character or a real jerk or a real seedy guy. And that's why I love There Will Be Blood.
Oh, such a great friggin' movie.
I love Magnolia. I love films like that. And I love films like The Royal Tenenbaums that can take a lot of characters and bring them together in a really creative way, or just have so many characters, but have them be so well developed and have them have so much life and so much rich backstory, but also just like keep things concentrated on the storyline and still have it be a very good, coherent film.
Yeah, I have most of those on Blu-ray that you mentioned.
Sure. Big Lebowski.
Oh my God. Big Lebowski might be my favorite comedy. I'm serious.
It's a great comedy.
It's so good. That is the quotable movie for me. I mean, I don't know what it is, but there is a shot in that movie that I just die laughing. And it's not, I don't even know if it's meant to be funny, but I die every time. Jeff Goldblum's in his car and freaking CCR comes on. He starts banging the roof. Down, 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 looking out my back door. And he's just, I don't know why. It kills me. It's so funny. It's like exactly what my dad did whenever CCR came on. It was just, it perfectly encapsulated that.
Well, I think it's a really awesome introductory moment for the character. You know, it did tell, like, that one moment for Jeff Bridges' character tells you like everything you need to know about that guy.
I love that part,
like right there, like what he's wearing, the car he's driving in, the fact that he's just banging on his steering wheel like a total dork.
If you go to any YouTube video of looking out my back door from CCR, almost always the top comment is like, I listened to this and I banged the roof of my car.
Absolutely. Just two more I have. My last movie pick here, I have one more question to ask you about movie stuff, and maybe then we can get into some music stuff. Love Reservoir Dogs. Definitely. I think, you know, as far as like extravagance and just like grandiosity, I love Pulp Fiction and I love Kill Bill a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But the thing about Reservoir Dogs is I also love a film that can take characters in a very limited amount of scenes, not scenes, but I guess settings, you know, sort of like a 12 Angry Men or something like that. You know, I mean, a bulk of that film and a bulk of Reservoir Dogs happens in the same spot,
Definitely.
You know, but yet the film is so action packed and it's so, it's just so engaging and it's just so just nail biting and just so on the edge of your seat. And it's, you know, it's really all because of the quality of the acting, you know. I mean, that movie could be transcribed to the stage, and if you've got some great actors, it would still be just as entertaining.
Yeah, and Tarantino infused so much energy into that movie to the point where he did something different with almost every shot in that movie, made something pop, something unique about every shot. Just the one scene where Tim Roth is describing that, I haven't seen it in a while, but Tim Roth is describing that experience and the cameras rotating around him 360. Just stuff like that is the kind of thing that most directors, they don't think of. they're just like, oh, well, we'll just cut to a close up and then we'll cut to a close up as they talk. We'll cut back and forth. No, Tarantino was doing so many innovative things with the camera. And he, I mean, that movie, obviously I was young when it came out, but I've since done a lot of research about its explosion and how it affected people. And it was huge for him.
Yeah, absolutely. It was his breakout film. I mean, it really gave him a name. And I think the last film I have over here is Jim Jarmusch's Night on Earth.
Haven't seen it.
Well, sort of going into that, generally, and I know you sort of review some films of this style, but mostly, you know, sort of larger films that, you know, your average Joe could catch in the theater if they make the point to. Sort of where's your focus or where's your priority or just your general opinion when it comes to just independent movies, independent films, and, you know, just sort of the more off the beaten path sort of stuff?
It's a great question. It gives me a chance to answer that because I get that a lot. Not living in LA or New York, it's automatically more difficult for me to.
Yeah, that stuff's not sitting outside your front door.
It's automatically more difficult for me to locate these films. Gratefully, in the past year, a really awesome theater has opened nearby my place called The Nightlight, and it's dedicated to bringing independent films to my area. So normally I have to drive to Cleveland, which is about a 40-minute drive for me, to see some of these smaller films. Now, the other issue is that a lot of these smaller films, no one wants to watch these videos, and it's the honest truth. I might drive an hour to see a film that I might not have much interest in, and maybe I think the film is okay, and I review it, and it's a small film, and it gets a certain amount of views, and then let's say a Batman v Superman trailer drops and people are begging me to talk about it, so I do, and it gets quadruple 5, 6, 7 times the views that the indie film that I drove an hour to see and sat in a theater for 2-3 hours even. And so it's sort of like a priority time thing, but to be the real answer is that I have a passion for movies. Doesn't matter if it's big or not. I do actually review a lot of indie films. It's just nowhere near as many as I can. And a lot of that, like I said, is due to the area. But yeah, I try to cover anime, which no one else on YouTube. Well, I'm sorry, that's absolutely incorrect. There are plenty of anime reviewers, but I'm saying the majority of YouTube film reviewers don't really give a crap about anime. So that I try to focus on that because it's such a small thing, but I also do.
That's actually something on your YouTube channel that you've been a pretty big advocate of.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't actually think I said I have the Akira DVD over here in
Very
front of
cool.
me. But yeah, you've been pretty defensive of anime on your YouTube channel and, you know, sort of talking about its significance in film history just in general.
Yeah, definitely. And that's something that I've tried to make people become aware of, because so often anime is viewed as the thing where the girls have the big boobs or whatever, or it's, you know, the childlike thing, Pokemon. But there's so much mature anime filmmaking out there, and so many American films have been inspired by it. I mean, it's crazy how many times I've been watching a movie and been like, I've seen that in an anime. And then I go back and I'm like, yep, it was in an anime, and they attributed it in some way, and no one really picks up on these things.
Even in the internet age where people have so much access to this stuff, I mean, those stereotypes still persist?
In some places, it's not like it's not as bad as it was. I mean, you know, where people, when I grew up, if you liked anime, it was kind of weird, you know, like, hey, what are you watching? Nothing.
Yeah, it was automatically a dorky
thing.
Yeah,
exactly. No, it's definitely considerably easier now to be like, anime is awesome. But I can tell you from personal experience, since I have been trying to advocate it, and I've gotten quite a bit of comments from people who are like, I really don't have any interest in anime. I don't like the animation style. I don't like the art style. And so it's sort of become not like I'm afraid to like it because of a reputation. It's become like, I just don't like the animation style. I don't know how though, because like, to me, like I have a friend, one of my best friends, who will watch every single American animated film released in theaters, no matter what, because he has kids, but he also enjoys them. But he will not even look at an anime. And I'm like, so why is it okay if you watch the American animation, but you don't watch Japanese? He's like, I don't like reading subtitles. I'm like, we'll turn on the dub. I'm fine with it. We'll turn on the dub and you can watch this movie with me. He's like, eh, I just don't want to. I'm like, why?
I think it's just a subliminal reaction to people just not being used to not only the visual style of anime, but I think subconsciously a lot of American viewers react to the average of about 10 frames per second in a lot of the anime films without even really thinking about it. I think that they're just not, I think that even though the visual quality in terms of like the detail and just, I mean, just like the intense detail of a lot of these drawings is there. I mean, kind of where you end up losing is sort of in the amount of frames that you get. And I think some American viewers sort of see that and automatically react to it, assuming it's some kind of loss in quality or that it's cheap in some kind of way when that's not necessarily the case. I mean, you could draw 30 fucking frames of The Simpsons because if you're a good artist, you could draw 30 Homer Simpsons in, you know, a pretty quick span of time. But I mean, when you're talking about like some of those battle scenes that occur in Akira, I mean, you know, those are some really intense drawings.
That's a really fascinating viewpoint. I've never looked at it that way. That could very well be for some people. The one I've always said, like when people are like, what's the gateway anime? I'm like, watch Cowboy Bebop, just do it. And give it the first 5 episodes. And if you're not hooked, okay. But I hope you are. That's all I say.
You know, thanks to I think because of the internet, Adult Swim, Toonami, you know, they've really heightened the reputation of anime from where it used to be years ago. You know, thanks to bringing stuff like Cowboy Bebop and Trigun and you know, stuff like Death Note and Dragon Ball Z too to the West.
Yes, definitely. That's how I feel too. I mean, and I made that whole video about Toonami and how it inspired me and. To Toonami Rewind, the retro rewind video I did. I'm getting emotional. To this day, that's my favorite video I've had the privilege to be involved in because I can actually watch that video and it's the only video that I can watch and not think of all the things I wish I had said differently.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm very proud of that video.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I think it came together really well, and I think it, you know, sort of defended the genre in the way that it sort of needed to be defended. You know, and not that, you know, it's sort of under severe attack nowadays, but I think, you know, anime, like a lot of different musical genres, you know, people just don't give it the chance it deserves necessarily. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess one more question about independent films, but not, you know, asking about any independent films specifically, just kind of from a critical standpoint, you know, obviously, and for me myself, you know, I kind of feel this pressure to review sort of the most popular of the popular stuff that comes out because that's often what people are asking the most for. And that's often what ends up, getting the most views. You know, but still at the end of the day, I kind of feel like if I just relegated myself to that, I would, start over time to feel kind of uninspired because I kind of feel like as a critic, it's sort of my job to curate as well and kind of introduce people to things. And I kind of feel like independent music, underground stuff is one of the most important ways to do that, to sort of shine a light onto things that people aren't necessarily focusing on.
Yeah, I agree. I actually generally tend to prefer independent music over the more popular stuff, but I do try to cover indie films. I mean, I'm obviously not doing as much as some, but like recently I did the Death of Superman Lives documentary. I wasn't even really released in a wide release at all. I picked up the Blu-ray at Comic-Con. I did Dope when Marnie was there. One of the things I'm doing right now is, and I'm really loving it, and I'm really surprised that people are actually enjoying it as much as I was hoping they would, is I'm reviewing films that are leading up to like a release that's coming out, like a film series, or maybe I'll pick a director and review his films. And it's giving me a chance to actually kind of build my catalog of reviews, because if you go to RogerEbert.com and search a movie, odds are he reviewed it. If you go to my YouTube channel and search a movie, maybe I reviewed it, and I don't want it to be like that. I want to have like a gigantic catalog of movie reviews. And so I'm really enjoying doing that.
Yo, me too, dude. Me too, dude. But just like album reviews, obviously.
Right.
Do you feel like sort of the movie mainstream right now is a little more or less creative than it used to be, or maybe more or less open to alternative ideas than it used to be? Because I feel like with the rise of Netflix and with the rise of the internet and just how it's kind of brought the underground to our front doors via a search engine, if we want to find it, it kind of has created a platform for films like Juno, like Garden State, like Little Miss Sunshine, that aren't necessarily true blue indie films, but they have more of an indie alternative aesthetic. Mm-hmm. And while maybe it might not be as gritty as some of those hardcore indie films, like a movie like Antichrist or something like that, it definitely puts the idea out there, or at least makes things in the mainstream feel a little more balanced. Like, we don't necessarily need to appeal to the lowest common denominator all the time. We can actually put out a film like Juno and Little Miss Sunshine, and it can be successful sort of in its own right.
Absolutely. And like you said, a lot of it has to do with the fact that we now have so many options with how we view films. And for instance, in August, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon 2 is going to be the first, as far as I know, the first film released in theaters and same day on Netflix. And so we're entering this new world of possibilities. And this is one of the things I've actually has drawn me more to TV shows, is the fact that I can binge watch on Netflix or whatever. Like, I watched Daredevil and I loved it. I have no interest in watching Arrow or The Flash, despite the fact that people tell me they're good. And the reason is I simply can't dedicate, you know, the time to all these cliffhanger possibilities. And so getting back to what you were talking about, the fact that Netflix offers the filmmakers and people involved with creating television shows more leeway and more freedom to explore their ideas, at least from what I've heard from reports, that's something that I think filmmakers are really flocking to. Like, for instance, take House of Cards, which I haven't watched yet, but the fact that David Fincher wanted to do it, I mean, that's crazy. That is one of the most meticulous directors on earth. The fact that he made a Netflix show, you know, and directed the pilot and I think a couple episodes, is great. I mean, that speaks worlds about the freedom they're giving artists. So I think that, yeah, to answer your question, Hollywood is very bogged down in what works and what gives them returns on their investments. And they know the little boxes they have to check most of the time to make sure they at least break even and hopefully make a little more. But there are so many other options now of how we can get our entertainment that it is giving artists, especially people who aren't even in the Hollywood system, like me, it's giving people like you and me the freedom to express ourselves creatively through things like YouTube. I mean, if I really wanted to, I could make a short film and start a Kickstarter campaign or a GoFundMe campaign or something and try really hard, and I could do it. It's just there's so many options now that allow us to, more creative freedom than we ever had before.
Yeah, I mean, I think the internet has kind of given us a little bit of accountability in the fact that, I mean, stuff has to actually kind of be sort of good now, because you can't just go from the fact that you promoted the movie really well or you promoted the album really well and people went out and bought it and these are the sales and it's over. You know, I mean, people are going to hear the record and see the movie and then they're going to take to online immediately and be like, this is great. This sucks.
Exactly.
And, you know, it's because of that actual passion that people have for projects. I mean, you know, once the internet allowed people to pirate music, allowed people to buy single songs on iTunes, allowed people to vent their expressions and their negative opinions about whatever records online, I mean, the music industry was in alarm mode and was talking about, oh, the album's dead, artists aren't going to be making records anymore, and people don't care about albums anymore, albums are dead, just stop making albums, albums are garbage. And then meanwhile, you have something like this Kendrick Lamar record that just dropped earlier this year, To Pimp a Butterfly, which has been like across, despite the fact that it's a hip hop record, it's been, you know, a crossover hit across young people of numerous musical tastes because of its story, because of its musical palette, because of just how in-depth the record is. And in the midst of this culture that critics and people who are just like culture writers are constantly saying that, oh, people don't have an attention span anymore, you know, and then you're handing them this almost hour long album, and most people coming across it are celebrating and saying it's one of the greatest hip hop records of all time, if not one of the greatest modern records of our era, I think says something. You know, I think people have the attention span if you hand them something worth paying attention to.
Yeah, no, I feel the same way. And I think that's a humongous misconception in regards to the way, whether it's a studio exec or a record company, is looking at something. People tend to be cynical about how someone is going to perceive something they've created. And it's just a natural human inclination. You know, people won't like this. Why? I don't know. People won't like it because of this and because of that. And like you said, if an artist really puts his or her mind to it, they can create something that's captivating. If you have talent and if you're actually good at what you do, you can create something, whether it's long or short, and it can be captivating. I mean, you know, say what you will about Interstellar. The movie's almost 3 hours long, but I was captivated from opening to ending. And that's the kind of thing that Hollywood or record companies need. They need people who can tell interesting stories through song or movie and actually captivate their audience, because there's this huge demand for having to make back a certain amount of money and all these worries. And like I said, all these little boxes that have to be checked to make sure it fits into this thing or fits into that thing. And I think that's really the death of creativity.
I think the industry, whether it be movie or whether it be music, is going to continue to subsist on these kind of quick hits where they can just, you know, make a movie for relatively cheap off of a basic idea that they could just make a bit of a profit off of. But I mean, the studios have to be more open to the bigger ideas that they might be taking a bit of a risk on, because the thing is, it's movies like that that end up sort of being those big cultural historical markers. Mm-hmm. Kendrick's new record, like Interstellar 2, which my wife is a huge movie buff, and especially when it comes to sci-fi stuff. So she was head over heels for the idea of that film before we even got into the theater. And she loved it from beginning to end. She thought it was amazing. Cool. And, you know, I thought some of the acting was just okay. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, just the whole concept of the movie and the way they played out sort of the idea of Matthew McConaughey just like getting caught in this alternate dimension and trying to sort of guide events from behind the scenes in a way in this other dimension was really great. It was really mm-hmm. cool. And I think that really, even if the movie, in your opinion, is it good or is it bad? I think it's grand ideas like that that are going to inspire directors into the future.
You got it.
I did see not too much recently this short little college film project festival thing at a local theater, and there was a complete lack of buddy comedies there, which I thought was really really disappointing. So you know, I think I think you know, while independent and grand ideas are good, we still need to be open to the buddy comedy.
Of course,
system
of course.
Well.
I mean, you got to have a lethal weapon every here and there.
Absolutely. So, going into some music stuff. I mean, with how movie and film obsessed you are, sort of what kind of role in your life does music play, and kind of what records have stuck with you over the years?
So, I am not a person who says this is my favorite genre of music, similar to movies.
Sure.
I like all different types. There's really only a couple genres I can't stand. That would be country music and like hardcore rap. Like
hardcore.
You know
rap.
What I mean? Like, you know,
how hardcore are we?
Like when every other word is a cuss word.
Okay. So like, you know, super, super foul mouthed
stuff. Yeah. It's like, I lose the artistry, you know, the artistry fades and all I hear is the overuse of language. Not a big heavy metal guy, but I do love rock. I like many different types of pop music. I like classical music. I listen to classical, in the car quite often. I love, surprise, surprise, movie scores. I will listen to plenty of those, for many years I have. I mean, my favorite album of all time is Michael Jackson's Thriller.
It's a great record.
It's a common choice. I know it's nothing crazy or different. It's like, my favorite movie is Transformers.
I would say saying Michael Jackson's Thriller is your favorite movie is kind of like saying, it's more like saying Terminator 2 is your favorite movie.
Okay. Well, yeah.
Like, okay, it's a common film, but it's an amazing fucking film.
Yeah, it's my favorite album. Billie Jean is my favorite song of all time.
It's an amazing
song. I've listened to it.
You know, some of my favorite songs rip off that song in some kind of way.
Yeah. I mean, tons of songs have taken the, you know, beats from it and sampled it in various ways. But no, I absolutely love that song. And a little secret for you. when I was a teenager, I became very obsessed with the Billie Jean routine, the live dance routine. Mm-hmm. And
dude, when my wife was a kid, she was Michael Jackson obsessed as well and knew all the moves and all that
stuff. Well, I spent about 3 or 4 years teaching myself how to do it, and I've performed it at a few talent shows and stuff, and
that's perfect.
I know the whole thing, like, from getting, and I'm not just a cursory like glance of it, like, and this is the one thing I can actually speak prideful about. I fucking can do the Billie Jean routine perfectly, and I'm being completely serious. Like, I can,
dude, video or it didn't happen. Just video, YouTube video. Dude, come on. We you're on YouTube. I'm on YouTube. We know how we make money. Yeah. If you did that, you'd probably get 1 million views.
I probably would, but the issue is Billie Jean's a copyrighted song. So, and that
dude, just do it totally silent. Yeah. Just totally silent. To like a click track.
Yeah, I'll be like, hey guys, you provide the Billie Jean track, and you know, put it over the video if you want. Here's me dancing.
Absolutely, just like give them a signal as to when to start the track.
Yeah, exactly.
And then just totally
do it. My goal is to one day actually do it in front of like a huge live audience. I have no idea how I could ever actually do that because you know. Hey, I want to do this thing. Someone put on a show for me. Yeah. Uh-huh. So, but no, it's a thing. That's for sure.
You make sure to practice it every once in a while just to make sure you can still do
just
it.
Just
right?
The other day, my wife, and I swear to God, this is true. My wife is sitting down and she's like, can you still do that Billie Jean stuff? And I'm like, do you doubt me, ma'am? And she's like, yes, I do. And so she found the song on her iPhone and started playing it. And I was in my living room and she was like, you can still do it. And I was like, yeah, I can.
Yeah. I mean, Thriller, a lot of that Jackson 5 stuff, Michael Jackson's more disco days with Off the Wall. I mean, that was just and Bad as well. I mean, that was a good run.
Yeah, no, I love it. And to be honest, I like a very underrated song of his, I feel, is Blood on the Dance Floor, that no one ever talks about. I find that song just incredibly infectiously toe-tapping, and I've listened to it hundreds of times, and no one ever talks about it ever because it was on a kind of shitty remix album that was just like an excuse to be a remix album. And but that one single I love, and I even like a lot of his Invincible album. I mean, I guess I'm a huge Michael Jackson fan basically, but no, Billie Jean was huge for me. It was the first time in my life that I heard a song that I was like passionate about. You know, like I was like, I don't know. It was just like, I'm passionate about this song. I want to learn this routine. Like I would film. Here's how I did it. I would film myself trying to dance like him. And then I would put it in my editor because I've always been editing, you know, video. I'd put it in my editor and then I'd line up MJ himself next to me. and I would look to see if I was doing it correctly. And if I wasn't, I would refilm myself and see if I had gotten it right that time. And I would actually overlap them and see, am I doing it like he's doing it? And I did that for about 3 years, honestly, like in my spare time.
I mean, that's why they all learn those choreography routines in those mirrored rooms.
Yeah.
When they're getting ready for a show, because, you know, they're watching themselves, they're watching everybody, and just kind of making sure that the whole routine is going down well. You're just doing it with a
camera. Exactly. And you know what? I've examined this to the point where I will sometimes look up other people who are impersonators or who are doing like a talent show, and I can't watch it because it's so bad. And it's because I see every flaw. And one of the biggest things I've seen impersonators do, and they're not realizing it, is they're doing it backwards, because they're looking at MJ and then they're trying to do it from that angle, not realizing that they're doing it backwards. Like, instead of like, MJ will kick to the left,
because it's kind of mirrored through the television.
And so they kick to what they think is the left, but it's their right. And I'm looking, I'm like, you're doing it backwards, dude. And this kind of stuff is what goes through my head. So yeah, that's my secret music side.
Well, that's a pretty, I mean, have you analyzed any of his other routines? Yeah. Because I mean, that's a pretty significant Michael Jackson routine. And I imagine that he recycles a lot of those same moves or similar moves pop up in his other routines.
Oh, of course. Smooth Criminal, Thriller. What else? You Rock My World. Yeah, I've definitely 100%. The Dangerous routine, I can do about half of that, but not very well.
Well, I think it was on, it might have been in the Smooth Criminal music video. I don't think it was. No, it was definitely in the Smooth Criminal music video. That's when Michael was dressed kind of in that white sort of gangster suit, correctly? Yep. Correct? Yeah, I mean, when he just sort of tips forward and everybody just sort of tips back, one of my favorite moves of his.
Yeah, and you want to know how he did it?
Oh, tell me. Tell me.
Because it's humanly impossible, first of all. And he's you know, been, he's not like he's hid this. He actually patented a pair of shoes that had these holes in the heel, and he hooks into the ground, literally. The heels of his shoe hook into the ground, and all the dancers, and they're able to tip forward like that, and then, you know, tip back and then unhook from it really quickly. And he does it in the live performances too. And there's only been a couple times where the shoe has broken, or the hook broke and he fell. And it's the only video I could ever find was somebody's like shaky 1995 camcorder thing of him falling. Sure. And that was it. But, yeah, he actually patented that type of shoe, and anyone who's ever had to do the Smooth Criminal routine for real as an impersonator, they have to have that type of shoe to do it.
Oh, okay, man. Yeah.
Dude, I told you I analyzed this shit.
that's true, man. Well, I mean, that's sort of where, well, I mean, given that you're into films, you're a very visual guy, and as far as, you know, people from his era, I mean, Michael Jackson was one of the most visual artists out there in terms of his dancing style and sort of the ambitious approach he would take with his music videos. You know, Michael Jackson, I mean, his music videos still have millions and millions and millions of views today on YouTube. So, I mean, sort of jumping off from that, you know, are there other sort of music videos that are sort of really significant to you from your childhood, or just kind of, you know, throughout your life of loving music, loving movies?
Well, by far the ones I've already mentioned are definitely the most significant. I don't know about music videos, and the reason is because so often, I think this is why I liked MJ so much, is because so often music videos are so standard. Very similar, you know, slow-mo shots of a pretty girl walking around and a guy is singing about her and maybe she's picking a flower. They're all the same, so many of them. Yeah, and I'm sure you can look at me and go, oh, you're so wrong, and give me a list of like incredible.
Oh, no, I mean, you know, I could give you a list, but I'm already imagining the music videos that you're describing, which also to me run in tandem with the really awful music videos of the 80s and 90s, which were essentially just movie commercials.
Yeah.
Where it would just be like cuts of the band, like, you know, kind of just lip syncing their songs, spliced together with clips from the movie that they ended up on the soundtrack of some crappy romantic comedy or something.
Yeah. Here's an embarrassing one. You want an embarrassing one?
Sure.
So I grew up loving Britney Spears. I had a picture of her in my locker in sixth grade, because, you know, sixth grade, she's the hottest girl on earth and everyone wanted to be with Britney Spears. So, yeah.
Lovers and haters alike who were heterosexual males and even homosexual males loved that Hit Me Baby routine.
Yeah, that
was like a significant
video. That's a good one. But the one that for some reason did it for me was the Oops, I Did It Again in that red leather skin tight suit. I, for whatever reason, when I was a kid, I was like, that's the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Sure.
But no, it's horrible. I mean, it's pretty stupid. It's not really very good at all. It's a very basic, you know, especially that scene where she's like, I thought the whole thing fell into the ocean at the end. Well, baby, I went down and got it for you. You shouldn't have. It's like the dumbest tangent ever in a song.
Yeah, I mean, I remember that whole era for music videos because and maybe you did this as well. I mean, I would come home from school, I'd freaking watch TRL.
Oh my God, Total Recall Live.
Come home from school, watch that Offspring video for Pretty Fly for a White Guy, watch the Christina Aguilera video.
Absolutely.
Watch who else had some big videos around then? I remember like there were tons of Limp Bizkit videos. Limp Bizkit was huge. Sum 41, yeah, people loved that video. 'Cause I'm in too deep and I'm trying to get
in too deep and fat just, lip.
Yep. Yeah. And just before that, I mean, that was a time when they kind of relegated the music videos to this one time in the day. I mean, even before that, when they were just playing music videos all day, you know, Nine Inch Nails, the videos for their stuff. I remember when I was a kid, like, and I liked horror movies at the time, but the Closer video gave me nightmares. Like, the Closer video would freak me out. Like, there was something super dark about that Closer video.
Absolutely. And just to clarify, I totally messed up. I called TRL Total Recall Live. It was Total Request Live, my bad.
Yes, Total Request Live. But hey, man, Total Recall, you're a movie
Yeah,
guy.
It was an easy mistake. My apologies. I see you at the party, Richter.
It's a lot of Arnold movies, man. A lot of Arnold movies.
No, I grew up in the time period that I'm most well-versed in regards to music is obviously when I was a teen. So, because that's when, you know, everyone was doing, you know, everyone in my school would, I vividly remember, I was a huge unpopular nerd in school. Like, you know, I had like a couple friends. And all of my actual friends that were like my best friends were from like people my family knew and I had just grown up with them and they didn't go to my school. So anyway, at school, I vividly remember the day in which I was most popular was when we had home ec class and it was like a party day or something. Like we were going to have food and candy. It was just like the greatest day ever. And I brought in my black boom box, this little boom box that I had. 'Cause you know, back then people carried around boom boxes.
Dude, I could not wait to get a boom box.
Of course.
When I was a kid and I had just a little Sony stereo that played tapes.
Yep.
And yeah, man, I couldn't wait to get my hands on
one when I was a kid. I brought in a cassette tape, and it wasn't an official cassette tape. It was like a blank cassette tape that I had listened to the radio and recorded my favorite songs onto. I would wait for I could hear, oh, they're about to play, record. And then I would, you know, and so I actually have in my head, like, memorized sort of like the audio transitions between songs of like a guy going, and that was Smash Mouth All-Star, okay. And then like going into the next song. So yeah, I brought in my cassette tape and I played Smash Mouth All-Star and the entire class started dancing. And it was like, I think it was 99 maybe when that came out. And
yeah, that's exactly
okay,
when it came out.
So yeah, I sound like an old fucker right now. But and everyone was dancing. I was like, I'm the most popular kid in school. I brought All-Star. I'm the best. And yeah, I mean, that was like the best day of my life when I was a kid. And so yeah, I've you want to know like the greatest arc to this is my first date with my wife. We went to a screening of Hotel Transylvania. And I remember I was like, I'm going to impress this girl. I get into these movies for free. It's going to be awesome. She's going to think I'm the greatest. And we saw Hotel Transylvania and we had a good time. And on the way home, we were playing music and All-Star came on. And she just kind of started mumbling the lines. And I was like, I'm going to follow along. And I started kind of singing. And then I swear, this is like the most cliched thing that could have possibly happened in the universe. But we both started singing All Star at the top of our lungs.
Sure.
And it was great. I was like, this girl's pretty awesome. And now we're married. So, and of course we had it at our wedding and it wasn't our dance song, but it was in our wedding playlist. So yeah, it was like a strange arc brought to you by Smash Mouth.
All Star is a pretty significant song to me for a few different reasons. Well, for one, there are two records, and this is a guy I've interviewed on the show as well. So this was a previous interviewee. There are two records that I reviewed either last year or the year before. I think it was last year. And they're remix albums. They're not remix albums. They're mashup albums. Mm-hmm. And they mash up different songs together. And he came out with two of them, and they're kind of sister albums. And the first one is called Mouth Sounds. And there's maybe like 17 or 20 tracks on it. And while not every track features a Smash Mouth mashup, most of the tracks do. Mm-hmm. And most of the songs that he mashes up with Smash Mouth, he mashes up with the song All Star. So you're hearing All Star's vocals thrown on top of John Lennon's Imagine, on top of, like, you know, he throws the lyrics to Walking on the Sun on top of Daft Punk's Better, Harder, Faster,
That's
Stronger.
That's interesting.
And have you know the band Modest Mouse?
Yeah.
Correct? You've heard the song Float On?
Maybe. If you were to play it, I'd probably recognize it.
Sort of, you know, completely unbeknownst to me, but he figured it out and he found out. The lyrics to All Star, with absolutely almost no alteration to the words and the instrumental to Float On from Modest Mouse, fit together and sync together perfectly.
Wow.
Like, it's almost as if they were meant to be together. And what's pretty funny is I've DJed a couple times, and I often will play this track to a crowd of maybe sort of snooty indie mm-hmm. types who at first we'll hear the Modest Mouse song, which is easily one of the most, you know, recognizable and hit indie pop songs of all time. It was a really significant record for its time because, you know, up until that point, it was kind of weird for a band that kind of had this long-running indie status to break out onto the charts and, like, you know, really crack into mainstream culture in some kind of significant way. And so they hear the instrumental and they hear the iconic guitar riff going, and then all of a sudden the fucking Smash Mouth dude pops in and he starts singing the All Star lyrics, and it's just so confusing. It makes no sense.
Right.
And I remember the one time I did a bunch of speaking engagements in Australia, and when I did play some music down there to a bar, the people got kind of caught off guard once the Smash Mouth lyrics started playing, but everybody started screaming them at the top of their lungs.
That's hilarious.
And yeah, it was pretty amazing. And also when I do these speaking engagements, I'll do a bit of a comedy routine where I will do a deep lyrical analysis of that song, talking about how motivational it is, and you know, and a bunch of other things, just really diving into the philosophy of all.
So you got a bit of a social experiment going on there.
Yeah, and it's pretty interesting to sort of see people's reactions.
Yeah.
And you know, and it's funny because that song, not that everybody likes it, but everybody knows mm-hmm. it. You know, it's just so ubiquitous.
Yeah, definitely.
And as a result, I can just sort of, you know, say, okay, I'm going to do a deep lyrical analysis of All Star, and immediately the whole room just starts laughing. Because, you know, not only is that a song everybody knows for whatever reason, you know, despite what kind of musical background you come from, but it's not a song anybody ever thinks deeply about, mm-hmm. you know, like I don't think anybody even people who enjoy that song, I don't think they've really given that much thought to what the lyrics mean or what he's trying to say. And not that the song is saying anything ultra deep, but, you know, sometimes it's funny to just sort of treat something, you know, with like this really high level of importance, like it's saying something super highfalutin when it's really
right,
not.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, I mean, those are some pretty significant moments in pop culture,
yeah.
in music history. I mean, is there anything, today, sort of more modern stuff that you know, sort of you're fascinated by or catches your
attention? Well, I do have a favorite band. Sort of, people ask me all the time, what's your favorite movie? Don't have one. Mm. Can't pick one. It's impossible.
I can't pick a favorite album. I've heard so many right. albums. Can't
exactly.
do it.
And the thing is, you might pick one, and then 2 months from now, you're like, that's not my favorite album anymore.
It'll be totally yeah. different. I mean, the only time I could do something like that is if somebody's like, okay, like, what's your favorite punk record from whatever year?
Yeah, exactly.
You know? And then like there, I could be like, okay.
Right.
You know, I could tell you then. Sort
That's
of.
Why I can do best and worst movies of the year, because then I can shrink it down to a restriction of some kind. So
sure.
But I do have a favorite band. And as of right now, and as of pretty much the past few years, it's Daft Punk. I love Daft Punk. I've liked everything that they've put out. They got me through my recent trip to LA again. I've been to LA 3 times this year, and so it was back and forth a lot. And I was like, I don't want to go. I had to get on the plane, blah blah blah. And I have their whole discography. And I was just like,
Discovery and Homework, two of the most important dance music records
yeah.
ever. And I remember when I was in high school and I was really super into punk music with this buddy of mine who was just as into punk music as me. You know, we started, and this was like during the days of Napster.
Oh my God.
We started downloading songs from Homework and we thought it was like the coolest
Napster
thing.
Napster and LimeWire. Let's see. Yeah. I'm not a...
And I don't know if you know, but they actually started off as kind of like this punk twee band.
Really?
Yeah. Named Darlin.
Interesting.
And they pulled the term Daft Punk from a negative review somebody gave of their song.
I knew
song.
That. Someone, the review said it was like a Daft Punky something.
Well, I mean, if you actually listen to the song, I mean, it really is not a good
right.
song. That got reviewed, and I could sort of see it, like, honestly, like I would have to agree with the reviewer, mm-hmm. but I loved that they took it and they turned it around and they ended up making a completely different style of music.
I'm not a huge fan of Human After All, the album that,
yeah, that's the rough spot. Yeah.
And once I did some research about it, I realized like, yeah, they only worked on it for a few weeks. Like I read into it, and they said that they dedicated like 6 weeks to creating a new album, and I was like, a month and a couple weeks, that's it. So between that and Random Access Memories, which I personally think is a fucking masterpiece of an album,
it's a great
they
album.
Spent like a ton of years. Like I was like, that's what you guys need to do if you're gonna, and they made what is probably their best album in my opinion. So but yeah, let's see, Harder, Better, Faster, Stronger.
It's interesting that you love that record, because I mean in a way it is very movie like
yeah, no, it's very cinematic. It tells a story. Like I can listen
kind of like a story of just electronic and dance music in general.
Yeah, but I mean like I can listen to that album, and it's so different from all their other things. I can't believe I forgot to mention this. I'm a huge jazz fan. I love jazz, and I'm not like hipster jazz, you know, like go to a club and snap my fingers. I really,
okay. Like, well, like what passes for, okay. Just name a couple jazz records you like or jazz players.
My favorite, person who's ever done any type of jazz is not a jazz musician. Her name is Yoko Kanno. She's a Japanese composer for anime.
Oh,
she
yeah.
did.
I mean, those Cowboy Bebop
yeah.
songs are amazing.
Oh my God, yes. But and she also did Kids on the Slope, which is an anime film about a jazz trio band. And she worked with all the a pianist or a pianist, whatever you want to say, and a drummer to create some really great stuff. And but yeah, I love old fashioned Miles Davis. One of my favorite film soundtracks of all time, and I don't know if you've ever heard it, but check out. If you haven't, Michael Mann's Collateral. It has The Roots. It's got Groove Armada. the Klaas Brothers, all these like great slow jam music. I just, I love that stuff. Like it's relaxing to me. I see city nightlife brimming with orange streetlights in my head and cars going by, and I can hear it just like, I feel like I'm in a beautiful city when I hear amazing jazz music. And yeah, I've always had a very soft spot for it.
I just want to, I mean, I don't want to have to extend the podcast any further than it has to.
Go ahead, man.
I'm
good.
Just love to recommend a ton of records.
No, go ahead. I'm good. I got plenty of time.
I mean, yeah. I mean, if you want to, well, I mean, let me close out. Let me recommend a few records to you that are recent, and you please recommend me a few movies that are recent that you're head over heels for.
And, let me get a thing to write on here so I can.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh wow, you're
No, I'll actually pay attention. I will take this into deep consideration.
Okay, I have a Sharpie and a pad right now.
I have my very old fashioned notes app on my iPhone.
Okay, there you go. little more new school than me. All right, so just based off of what you just sort of recommended, I would recommend to you, not that I've loved everything that this artist has done. I mean, a lot of people are sort of mad at me because I have given his stuff some negative reviews. But, you know, I'm just kind of recommending it based on what you've said about Michael Jackson. This guy who makes music under the name The Weeknd. Mm-hmm. And you just spell it like weekend, but you have to take out the E in end. It's kind of just end.
So Weeknd.
Instead of the... So The Weeknd, that guy, I mean, it's much slower, it's much sadder, it's much more depressing R&B in one sense, but his vocals, in a lot of ways, he pulls right from Michael. And he has this third project called Thursday, which I believe is my favorite project of his. And he actually does a cover of Michael Jackson's Dirty Diana on it.
Dirty Diana.
Which isn't too bad. So definitely try him.
I'm a big R&B fan too. I grew up loving Boys to Men, and
I had that Boys to Men tape too, man.
Yeah, I had.
And TLC.
One of my favorite songs on one of their albums is not a single. It's actually a B-side song. It's called You Know. Mm-hmm. Check it out sometime.
Okay. Given your love of jazz, I'm going to give you a jazz, like a mountain of jazz right here. This new record called The Epic from the saxophonist, composer, this band leader, his name is Kamasi Washington. And it's a triple album, but it's kind of like three separate albums together. Like each record has a great intro track, has a great outro track. Don't feel like you need to listen to all the records at once. You know, slowly digest each one. Just treat it as if you've been handed three different albums and you're going to get around to the next two when you do, you know. But that is an amazing jazz album, which is very diverse. Everything from the hard bop stuff to just smoother stuff to vocal jazz and funk jazz. And there's a really amazing cover on there of Claire de Lune.
Oh, nice, nice.
Which they did a really amazing jazz rendition of that on the third disc, which I honestly just got a chill up my spine just thinking about that track because of how good it
is.
Two more. You know, if you're looking for some R&B that's newer, that has a very interesting kind of alternative direction to it. This singer by the name of FKA Twigs has this record out by the name of LP1. And it's easily the most progressive oddball R&B record I've ever heard, but she's got such a great voice. And the instrumentals are just really crazy detailed and modern. I'm trying to think of like a film that just has a really strange, abstract, modern aesthetic that you could liken this record to, but there's not really anything that I could think of. It's kind of impressionistic.
No, you got me. You know why? Because you've got me down. You definitely understand. Because in here in my notes, I kid you not, I was at a record store the other day, and I said, "What is this song?" And it was I have it right here, LP1, written down already in my notes.
So definitely check that out. And then finally, another jazz record, but it's a really cool modern approach involving electronic music and a bit of influence from hip hop and editing as well. But Flying Lotus's new record. Do you know him at all?
Definitely heard the name.
He's a great producer, electronic music producer, Coltrane relative, okay. And he works with people like Herbie Hancock on this new record of his, and more modern players like this fantastic virtuoso bassist by the name of Thundercat, and his new record again. It's titled "You're Dead, You're Dead," and that album is freaking amazing. And you know, there are some people. If you go into that record into the features list and on the musicians list, you could individually look up a lot of those musicians and see that they have amazing records too. Like Thundercat, who's all over that record, has great music. Kendrick Lamar, who's featured on that record, has great music. So you know, don't hesitate to sort of look up the people that he works with on that record.
Cool.
Too.
I definitely will. I got to ask you a quick question, musical related.
Sure.
Are you at all into like classic rock or 80s guitar solo band type deal?
I think so, yeah. I mean, what band, in your opinion, sort of fits
so
that?
So there's a song that a band that I feel is very underrated, and a musical artist in general. His name is Mark Knopfler, lead singer of Dire Straits in the 80s. And he did a song called Sultans of Swing. And if you ever feel like listening to like an 11-minute guitar orgasm, check that out, the Live Alchemy version of Sultans of Swing. And the final 4 minutes, I get goosebumps. It's amazing.
That's awesome. So does that track take a kind of a jazz tone?
No,
well?
It's hardcore, not hardcore, but it's just like very,
it's just like straight rock.
He's not the best singer on earth, but his lyrics are very meaningful if you look into them and read them. But his control of the guitar is godly. Like I have people always talk about Jimi Hendrix or, you know, Stevie Ray Vaughan, and I'm always like, Mark Knopfler, man, check him out sometime. He really knows his shit.
Yeah, there are a lot of there are a lot of amazing guitarists out there that are sort of off the beaten path, or just guys who are sort of around that same time and are known more for other things than they are just for their amazing guitar playing. I mean, Prince in his own right was an amazing guitar player.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, if you listen to records like 1999 and Purple Rain, you'll hear some amazing guitar playing all over that album. Frank Zappa, you know, amazing guitar player, though he's kind of known more for being like a weird musical oddball than he is just a great guitar player, though he was incredibly influential to guys like Steve Vai, who helped him, you know, kind of like transcribe his solos so that he could work them into these big compositions that he would create. You know, and we have some modern characters as well, like Jack White and stuff like that, you know, who are fantastic guitar players in their own right. But I've written that down. So recommend to me and the listeners as well, you know, sort of movie wise, you know, what you're really crazy about lately, what just sticks out to you from this past year, maybe the few past years, is like, you know, just really amazing
stuff.
Sure.
I don't know if you got a chance to see Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, that movie was fucking balls to the wall insanity.
Yeah, I loved it. I loved it.
Oh, man. It was just so over the top. From the battle scenes were just amazing. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's I think there are things that I kind of nitpick at in movies, and maybe it's because like I'm not always watching movies, and maybe if like it was just my home base, I would be a little more forgiving. Just like probably, you know, there are probably things that would probably make it that would be obnoxious to you in albums that I think are the greatest thing to ever exist.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, that movie was just such an onslaught. Like, by the time it was over, I felt like I ran a marathon. I felt like I was there in every battle scene. I was just like, like, I was watching the movie and I'm like, okay, in every action movie, there's got to be some point at which it slows down and all the characters are like, you know, kind of having a bit of a powwow around a fire or some shit like that. And I'm just like, how are they going to do that? Like, how is that even going to occur?
I know.
You know, and then when they got kind of caught, you know, sort of in the middle of the desert and it was night, I was like, okay, you know, that's working. You know, that's logical. It's sort of that definitely fits. But I just wish, Tom Hardy had a little bit more dialogue in that movie.
Yeah.
And not at the hand of taking lines away from Charlize Theron, because she was amazing. But I mean, you know, even I can't remember the actor's name, but who played one of the henchmen, one of the white guys who also played Beast in the X-Men
movie. Nicholas Holt.
Yes, he even had more lines than Tom Hardy.
What a lovely day. It's a lovely day.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, but he was along for an amazing ride. And I mean, you know, it was really crazy. And, you know, just the editing on the fight scenes and everything was just so raw and just so, it was just as overwhelming as everything else that was going on. It was just so killer. It was just nonstop adrenaline from beginning to end.
Okay. So this year so far hasn't been very impressive movie wise.
Really?
Most of the films that I've seen that I was really excited about were even if I liked the movie, it was disappointing because I wanted to love it. Like, I didn't love Avengers 2. I liked it. You know, I didn't love Ant-Man. I liked it. Didn't love Tomorrowland. I enjoyed it. You know, it's like, it's certain, I suppose, a movie that's come out this year that I thought was pretty impressive that not a lot of people have talked about is called Predestination, and it's with Ethan Hawke and Sarah Snook. Sarah Snook was from Australia, and she is going places. She was amazing. Haven't posted my review for it yet because I just saw it, but Southpaw, really liked it.
Yeah, how was
really
that?
Liked it. Yes. Really? And it follows every boxing cliche you can possibly think of, and it embraced.
I mean, it really has that working against it. I mean, there's so many infamous boxing films out there, and just fighting films now in general. Now that the UFC has kind of become incredibly popular, and wrestling films too.
But it embraces it, though. It doesn't. It's not. It's just like, yeah, we know we're gonna have a boxing movie with family drama and a down on his luck dad who needs his daughter and a big final climactic boxing match. You know, it's like, it's all there. You could take all the characters in this movie, replace them with Sylvester Stallone, and you'd have Rocky VI. And that's, that's what it is, but it's so well acted and so, uniquely directed by Antoine Fuqua, who made Training Day. And he brought a really gritty realism to the movie, and Gyllenhaal is, of course, just, he's been knocking it out of the park in every movie lately, and he's magnificent in the role. But I gotta say,
yeah, I mean, great acting can really elevate script, you know. I mean, because they're, you know, if it's convincing, you know, I mean, that was my favorite thing about Birdman, that it all just felt so convincing.
Yeah, and I gotta say, though,
I mean, everybody's acting was so intense.
The most surprising part of Southpaw is his daughter. This little girl, man, I'm not exaggerating. She is worthy of a Best Supporting Actress nomination. She was just fucking phenomenal. Like, I believed every word out of her mouth, and she couldn't have been more than 8 or 9. She was great. So this year, I'm still kind of waiting for, like, except for Fury Road, and I loved when Marnie was there, the Studio Ghibli's Possible last film, which is sad, but I loved that movie. Inside Out was very good. But speaking of last year, give you a couple things. Did you have a chance to...
Before you say that really quick, what did you think of Dope? Was Dope good? Did Dope turn
out
good?
I like Dope a lot. I like Dope a lot. Okay. And you would really like it more probably even because it has a lot of stuff about like music. Tons of stuff. A great soundtrack. Great hip-hop.
Yeah, I've heard. I've been meaning to sort of make the time to
great
watch it.
Great hip-hop soundtrack. And lots of scenes where characters just sit down and discuss like the inception of hip hop and how hip hop became to be, and just like stuff that doesn't actually have to do with the story, but there's tons of musical discussion. You'd definitely dig it. That's a good one. I gave it a B+. I think it's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
last year, a couple indie films. You asked about indie films. I loved Enemy with Gyllenhaal. Confusing as hell. I made a 30-minute video about it. Under the Skin with Scarlett Johansson, another very...
I loved Under the
good.
Skin.
Oh, good. You're good.
That movie was creepy.
Good. Yeah, that's a very divisive movie. Very divisive.
It's a very just really skin-crawling movie. And I loved that she... You know, it seems like in the internet age, big actresses like her can sort of duck out to do a strange, more low-key movie like that. And it's totally cool.
Yeah, and she rocked it. I'll give you one more. Did you see The Babadook?
No.
Okay,
no.
You mentioned you liked horror. The Babadook is a very low-budget, Australian-made film. Female director, female lead. And Jennifer Kent is her name. And she has given, in my opinion, the best directorial debut I have seen in years. And I'm not just judging it based on gender. Man or woman, best directorial debut I've seen in years. It's a very skin-crawling movie. Don't watch the trailer. Please. It markets it as a monster film. It is not a monster movie. It's a psychological thriller.
Okay. That you just made that sound really enticing.
Good.
Which is your job. So that's
I'm glad. That's... Well, hey, I want to listen to some of the albums you recommended. So
yeah, please do. Please do. And, you know, if we can get together and do a video and talk about a soundtrack or something.
Boy, I just love the Indiana Jones soundtrack. Yeah, no.
Yeah, I mean, if some movie comes out with a really great soundtrack, you know, that people are asking me to talk about, I would love to have you on just to talk about
it. I would be.
You know, I mean, you know, I could talk about what's going on musically, and I would love to sort of hear from you how it, in your opinion, sort of enhances the film.
I would be more than happy to do that.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. Again, I want to thank my guest, Chris Stuckman. I will link you guys down to his YouTube channel in the description box where you check out his fantastic movie reviews. Thank you for the recommendations, and thank you for coming on to talk to me.
I had a great time, dude. You're really fun to talk to, and I appreciate all the nice things. Thank you very much.